Welcome to the Raising Your Game podcast, where I bring to you the stories, insights, and ideas from those in the world of sport to help you build a stronger mind, more resilient body, and healthier life. Whether you're an up-and-coming athlete in the making or a seasoned professional, this show promises to give you something that you can use for positive change and help you in raising your game. Hey, welcome back to the podcast. I'm Lewis Hatchett, and in this episode, I'm speaking with the incredible Sam Willoughby, former Olympic silver medalist and former world champion in BMX. Sam has one of the most incredible stories in the world of sport, having gone from the 2016 Olympic Games to 3 weeks later, having an accident in a regular training run that left him diagnosed as a C6 tetraplegic and left him in a wheelchair. His story is one of the most incredible highs and some of the lowest lows. But from it has come his huge resolve for life and an outlook that's infectious and thought-provoking. I encourage you to take time to listen to Sam's story, listen to the views he now has, and how you can perhaps look within your own life to create a more positive, grateful, and resilient perspective. So I'm super excited to give you Sam Willoughby. Enjoy. Sam, thank you so much for jumping on. You're all the way over in San Diego. I was just saying how weird it is that I'm in your hometown and you're all the way over in San Diego with the time difference there. But how have you been? What have you been getting up to recently?
Yeah, thanks for having me on. It's been obviously a different 12 months for the whole world. So we've I was in Australia actually in February of 2020. With my wife. She had a World Cup in Shepparton in Victoria. And basically, since we got home from that, the whole world stopped. Mm. And so we've very much just been at our house here in San Diego and build a gym at the house and things like that, so that at least my wife could keep preparing for the upcoming Tokyo Olympics. And spending a lot of time at home, which hasn't been terrible. I'm a bit of a homebody, so...
Yeah,
it's been okay. We've built a home gym, which is something I've always wanted. I've started a bit of a bourbon whiskey collection, so that's what this room is that I'm sitting in. So we built that room. We've just done a lot of home projects, I guess, in the so-called quarantine year that 2020 was.
I think everyone's doing that. I think even when we had this mini 4-day lockdown over here in Adelaide, yep, when it was a bit of a mini lockdown, whatever it was. But my housemates, they were like, right, we're renovating, we're going to do loads of different things. And and then once it stopped or got told that it wasn't going to happen, the lockdown, they're like, oh my God, no, I've got nothing to do now. I've renovated everything. Everyone's houses are going to be changed.
The same thing.
Yeah, it's just such a thing to do. You're just pottering around the house and, oh, change that. Yeah. We'll just change the fencing, paint everything three times over.
That's right.
That's what we've got to do.
Yep.
so what is your day-to-day look like at the moment? What have you been doing over... You're saying you're training Elise, and we can get onto that as well about your coaching, but what does a day-to-day look like for Sam?
Yeah, so day-to-day, I'm full-time coaching. Obviously, the main priority, my wife, Elise, getting ready for Tokyo. And so I work with Elise, her training partner, Lauren Reynolds, who's actually Australian and is in a good spot to go to Olympics for Australia. Anthony Dean, who I grew up racing with, is also Australian, and a young kid over here in America. Well, he's not a kid, he's 19. Cameron Wood, so he's an up-and-coming, who just won his first pro race over here in January. So between those four, that kind of is my day-to-day job, coaching and managing the preparations day-to-day and monitoring things. So pretty much, I guess, a typical day is get up around 7, jump on my wheel up to my ski erg thing and put in a good 30 minutes of cardio. And then generally I'm the barista of the house, so I go down and make the coffees. And then it's off to training we go. And we have the Olympic Training Center 5 minutes from our house, the USA Olympic Training Center. So that's where my wife trains day to day. So we generally are either there or at our gym here at the house. And then, yeah, come home and to have a few hours off. And that's sort of where I either do a bit of study or whatever, take care of some emails. And then we go into our second session, wherever that might be, either at the track or in the gym. And then in the evening, I'll generally try to get in the gym myself. So I'll try to convince either one of them to pass me some weights or call up one of my mates to come over and hand me some dumbbells so I can have a go at it. And yeah, and then it's dinner time and the days are full.
Yeah. Wow, yeah. So you're doing 2 a days training?
Most days are, yeah. I'd say sort of, yeah, 5 days a week are pretty much 2 a days, yeah.
And the ski erg's a beast. That thing will take you down.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't have a great appreciation for it. It's something I bought about a year ago to try to. It's since my injury, it's really hard for me to get cardio just because, well, when it first happened, like I couldn't actually get my heart rate above 110 because it was obviously my injury was so high, being in my neck, like my respiratory was affected. But since having the ski erg, it's something that I can push pretty hard on, and I've been able to get my heart rate back to sort of regular heights again, which has been really good. Yeah, so that's been a good workout for me. And it's just simple. I can roll up to it and get into it. It's probably a little different to how the average person would use it. You know, they can use their legs a bit more. It's a full body workout for me. It's just a complete tricep and lat blowout.
Yeah, you're taking them down. That's I could imagine that. That's I'm trying to throw as much as I can into those things when you're on them. And
yeah,
and even when you see people that use them on a lot of CrossFitters use them as well. And,
yep.
And they're really smashing it. And they if anyone's ever not done one, jump on a ski erg and you'll thank us later.
Hard work.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So for you, let's wind it back to when you first started getting into BMX, and obviously you're in San Diego, but you've been out in America quite a lot. So what was your journey getting out there? Why America? But where did it all start originally here in Australia?
Yeah, so it all started, I grew up in Trott Park, but that family still all lives, though they live in a family home. My brother actually built a house just around the corner, so they're all still in the Trott Park area. And just grew up mad on bikes. Me and my brother Matt, we just rode all over. We used to get on the expressway path, which you could go from, like you still can, from Trott Park all the way to Seaford Rise. And just ride along there. And there was always bike jumps along the way. Like we'd stop off in Old Ranella at that half pipe there near Junkford Corner. There used to be jumps there. And then you'd stop in Woodcroft. There was more. And then Hackham, there was more. And then eventually you'd end up at the Seaford Skate Park. And then Mum would be coming down there, you know, once it went dark to bring us back home. So that was kind of like childhood. I was really lucky. Just had a great childhood and really supportive parents. And I don't have the story of a rough childhood, that's for sure, thankfully. And so just grew up mad on bikes and also playing footy, did Oz Kick, and then played footy all the way through primary school and pretty much up until I was about 16, played locally at Flagstaff Hill and did a few, you know, SAPSASA and state things when I was younger, and played a lot alongside Alex Carey, who we spoke about a bit earlier. So him and I were good mates and sort of did the same pathway in junior footy days, I guess. I guess that was my childhood. And I was probably pretty early on, around 8 years old, I had told my parents I wanted to get to America and race BMX professionally. And
wow.
That was sort of my dream. And I think I just had this burning desire to not work a real job. And BMX just seemed like a path that I could take and kind of direct. It was all up to, it was an individual sport. So, you know, I wasn't relying on selection or anything like that. It wasn't, I loved footy, but it was obviously, it's a team sport. And in those younger years, there's half the team serious, half the team's, you know, just out there having a kick, and which is good as well. But for me, I was pretty competitive and serious, and I wanted to win everything I did. And so BMX allowed me to probably achieve more younger, but then obviously the footy pathway probably ends up being a bit better as you get older. But for me, I wanted to just travel the world and try to win races and just set my own path, I guess, and BMX allowed me to do that. So from a young age, that was flicking through magazines and seeing BMX in America, and it just looked kind of brighter and bigger. And I just wanted to get there. You know, they were racing at these indoor arenas, and all the sponsorship was here because all the bike manufacturers were based here. And yeah, I was just hell bent on getting to America. So it was around when I was 16, just turned 17, I'd saved up, I had won my first junior world title in China. And after that, mum and dad were kind of like, well, if you save up enough cash to get a plane ticket, you know, we'll support you and let you go over there and do the last 3 months of the season. That was end of 08. So I did, I saved up enough money to get this Air China plane ticket that went like Adelaide, Sydney, Taiwan, Taiwan, LA. And then I found myself in America, and that was kind of where it all started. And I ended up winning my first professional race by end of November. And then, yeah, basically got picked up by a sponsor, by Redline Bikes over here. And yeah, I think, and then mum and dad quickly realized that 3 month trip turned into 10 years later, never coming home.
Wow. That's so you did that trip on your own. You went out on your own and.
Yeah.
And you were how old at that age?
So I was 17, just turned 17. Wow.
Just flying over the other side of the world, just mad going on this.
Yeah,
this journey.
I didn't think anything of it back then. Looking back at it now, you know, I meet 17 year olds and I'm like, man, how did I do that at that age? You know, and like, but I was fortunate in that I was never in a position where, you know, mum and dad were never going to just leave me stranded on the streets of LA. But so I always had that kind of that lifeline to call home. But for the most part, it was kind of, they gave me the freedom to find my way, and pretty appreciative of that now. And looking back, it was a big thing for them to set their 17-year-old son free and go to America and just figure it out.
Yeah.
In many respects. So, yeah.
So what was it that really ignited that fire in BMX over everything else? What was it that drew you to BMX compared to everything else?
Well, I think early on, bikes were just something that was like our form of transportation around the neighborhood. And then we loved motocross, but mum and dad didn't really want to get us motorbikes. So that was like kind of the next best thing, I guess. And it was, and then once we went and started racing, it was just the competitive side of it. I just was drawn to that like head to head competition. And it was, you know, me versus you. And we had, you know, you can create your own destiny with it. You know, you win that race, and then BMX is very much it's pretty open in the respect, you know, you can just sign up and go to the world championships and try your luck and try and become world champion. So it's all getting a little more, you know, with the Olympics now, there's a lot more of a qualification process. But back then, you know, as a 10-year-old, you could be world champion. And I think that's good and bad for the sport's development. But yeah, that was kind of what drew me to it, I think.
And for people who probably don't know too much about the event of BMX, just explain a little bit about what it is and how it works, how you sort of win. Obviously, it's a race, so winning is crossing the line first. But explain sort of the systems around the whole event.
So it's eight people on the track at once. You line up in a start gate or evenly spread across like a track and field race. Eight people on the start gate, and it's basically a track's range from around, you know, 4 to 450 meters, and then depending on how they're built with different jumps and the surfaces and downhill gradient or flat can change the times that the track takes, but on average somewhere between 35 and 45 seconds. And a typical race would be three heats, and then out of that you'll get down to a quarterfinal. So then they'll out of the heats, they'll qualify the top 32 down to a quarterfinal, and then there'll be four racks of eight people in the quarterfinals, and the top four from each rack will go into the semifinal. So they'll cut down to 16, and then the top four from each semifinal will make up the gate of eight for the final. And then most BMX races are one lap sort of to determine the winner, really.
So that is like a bit like any sort of motorsport where the tracks are all different.
So every track's different. There's some standards of, things now, like at the World Cups, for example, at the elite level, the start ramp is a specific dimension. So it's 8 meters high. And then there's a certain degree that the first 8 meters are, and then a certain degrees that the next bit is. So that's become a standardized start ramp. That happened when the Olympics came about. The gate itself, like the mechanism, the gate that falls, which you start behind, that has to drop at a certain speed. And so once you get up to the elite level, there's some technicalities that the tracks have to abide to. But for the most, like, tracks can be, they're all totally different.
And you get to go and have a look at them. You get to obviously you've got your heats, so you're having multiple goes at it really to begin with, but you're getting there days before, practicing on it, getting used to the track. Is that each individual gets
every event? Yeah, every event's different. That was one of the hardest things when I came to America, was you'd go to these little rodeo arenas where they'd build the track, and you would get 25 minutes of practice Friday night, and then you're on the gate to race at 10 a.m. Saturday morning. That's what I found really tough, because typically growing up in Adelaide or around Australia, we'd show up, 3 days before the race. You're generally racing on a track you'd been to before, so you knew it, you'd seen it, and you do plenty of practice. You get fine-tuned on the track, and then you go race. Whereas this was like all the best guys in the world show up to this little rodeo arena where the track's tiny and it's all new, everything's crowded in this little arena, and 25 minutes, learn the track, and then we're going racing the next day. So that was an adjustment for me. Yeah.
Did you get some sort of system in place or way of figuring out how am I going to utilize that 25 minutes to my best?
Yeah, it was really about me just learning to kind of back your abilities, and you look at a track, like you can go in the arena, take a look at it, and you've got to just start thinking quicker on the flying, like, okay, I know how I'll take that jump, and not be so, analytical, I guess, of when, once you're out there, it's got to really be just, get as much done as you can in that 25 minutes and be a bit more aggressive with your approach of how you look at a track. And fortunately, I've never been a super analytical rider when it comes to like, can I jump that or how much speed do I need for that? I just kind of would go out and do it and see what happened. So that played to my strength a bit, but I had to make that adjustment and ramp my intensity up a bit, I'd say.
So as for what the attributes of a BMX rider, what do you believe makes a great BMX rider? What made you so great? Is it the mental, the physical, the emotional capacity for it? What is it that makes a great BMX rider?
Yeah, I think it's having a lot of understanding of yourself and your abilities, because at the end of the day, like all sports, you're vulnerable. You go up to a start ramp, you go out onto a football field, whatever sport it is, you're very vulnerable in that moment. You're one mistake away from being judged. You're one mistake away from losing. So I think it's being comfortable in those vulnerable states and having an ability to assess your own abilities and an understanding of what your processes are and how you execute your best effort. And that's the hardest, under pressure is the hardest time to do that. So I was fortunate, I think, in the respect that I was raised, my mom grew up on a farm. She was a school teacher. So she's very process driven individual and kind of drilled that into me at a young age. So I was very like step by step and took every day that I did. I've got training diaries from 2006, every day of my professional career, I have it written in a diary with goals and ticks and crosses, and it's kind of analyzed everything from that perspective pretty in depth and built a really good understanding of what made me get the best out of myself. So I think that's a huge part of it. And then from the physical side, it's a very explosive sport. So anyone that's type 2 dominant with those sort of fast twitch fibers is obviously at an advantage. but all that's, you know, it all that those kind of traits are trainable. And so I guess we train in the difference, I guess, from BMX from other cycling disciplines is that we spend a lot of time at really high cadences, like pretty much after the first 10 meters we're up between 150 and 200 RPM. So it's you know, you have to be really good at having power at those higher cadences, I guess. And that's different, like, from track cycling, where it's, you know, they it's a lot more grunt, you know, lower cadences and a lot more of a strength aspect to it. So it's like any sport. You can look at it and say it's very simple, be good on your bike and get to the front of the race and win, or you can really break it down and complicate it more.
Because it's tight, like there's you're all bunched together, like it's really it is really packed, even those eight of you. What is there a certain type of build that gets a better advantage on in that situation, or is it purely like get out the gate, get through the front as quick as you can?
Yeah, I mean, that's an ongoing debate. Some people say like tall people are more advantaged around the track because, you know, if the jumps are deeper, they can kind of get their bike in and out of them deeper jumps a lot better and can, you know, stretch the longer legs and be able to manual through the jumps better. But then, you know, a shorter, more explosive person maybe gets out of the start better. So I don't know if there's an optimal build, but it's really, the explosivity part of it, getting to turn one is a big portion of the race. So if you're someone that has a good gait starting technique and you have those explosive abilities and, you know, really powerful on a bike, I mean, the top guys are pushing up around 2,500 watts on a bike. So they're probably some of the most powerful cyclists in the world.
Yeah, wow.
So it's a very explosive sport.
Well, I didn't know those sort of numbers were existing for a BMX rider. That's insane. Those are high, high numbers.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy.
So you personally, you had success pretty early and you were pretty good. You're very good. And then you're getting yourself to the Olympics. Talk us through your experience of the London 2012 Olympics. What was it like getting there?
Yeah, it was. So I was sort of coming into the fold, I guess, of elite BMX right around Beijing. But I was, at the time, there was a rule that you couldn't go unless you were 18. So I was still 17 then. So I wasn't old enough to go. My eyes were pretty firmly set on London, and I had a pretty quick rise through those next 4 years. And going into London, I was the world champion, and just, yeah, getting there was it. The experience was, I don't know, it's a hard one to re-explain, because looking back at it now, obviously it worked out well. I got a silver medal and it's very, you know, fond memories, but those first few days of competition, like I struggled a lot just on that, you know, you get there and you, in the lead up, I was all fine and, you know, kind of going through my paces and was, you know, had a great preparation. And then you get there and you realize that stage and you put on the Australian track suit and you realize, you know, that it's so much bigger than yourself. And for me at 20 years of age, that it got to me a little bit. And normally those things typically didn't at, you know, world championships and other events, but that one did a bit. And just London did such a good job of the Olympics compared to, you know, the other one I went to in Rio. Like, London was just obviously a huge sporting country, similar to Australia, and very passionate about sport and competition, and they just did such a great job with the whole facility. And BMX was like right in the middle of the village. You know, we rode our bikes. You could walk to the BMX race from the village. And it was just, yeah, looking back now, it's like all fun memories. Like, it was an amazing experience and probably one of the best experiences of my life. But I remember those days there in the village, like where it was, when I came into my room, I had like three big duffel bags full of handwritten letters from kids at primary schools in Australia, and just like, I started reading through all of them, and it was amazing. Like, I couldn't believe that all these kids had taken the time to, you know, send these encouraging messages. But it definitely made me go like, wow, this is different. Like, this isn't this isn't the World Championships. This means a lot more to a lot of people. So,
yeah, yeah, it's obviously getting exciting with the Olympics coming up later on this year. And what did you learn? Did you go into Rio differently? Did that experience change?
Yeah, I did.
Change something for you?
Yeah, it did. But I think if anything, I just went in more aware of it. And I would say I handled it all a lot better in Rio, but consequently came out with a worse result. So it's just the ebbs and flows of sport and BMX, especially. It's like you got to be in the right place and at the exact right time. It's 40 seconds where your kind of destiny of 4 years of work is decided. And I would say just, I think that's one of the biggest things I preach is just acknowledging all those what ifs and acknowledging all the, potential distractions and just being ready for them and not trying to create the ultimate perfect scenario, because it's just not practical in most settings.
Yeah, that's really interesting that you're prepping yourself for almost every eventuality that you may face.
Yeah, that was a big part of my prep with my sports psych, who I'd actually worked with in London and was still working with by Rio. And it was really, for us, it was about acknowledging, like putting them down on paper, all the, you know, actually going in depth and thinking about kind of all the things that could go wrong, I guess, and all the things that could be distractions, and acknowledging them and coming up with coping strategies for them when they did arise.
Mm. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. So if you don't mind moving on to the accident and what was the lead up to that? What was going on and sort of in the days leading up to it and on the day itself?
Yeah, so my accident actually happened about 3 weeks after the Rio Olympics. And I'd gone into Rio in really good shape and was actually the favorite to win the race and qualified first for the final. Found myself was in lane one, got a great start and just made a little mistake on the first jump where I just left my back wheel down a little too long and ended up coming up a hair short on the jump. And that's kind of all it takes in BMX to lose your momentum down that first straight. And then it's a downhill track and kind of just couldn't really make the passes I needed to make from there. And that was, it was a pretty, of a disappointing blow for me at the time. And right after the Olympics, I actually torn my ACL in March leading into Rio. So I knew that, you know, Rio was really, that was kind of the one thing that I felt. And I felt a lot of external pressure as well in that everyone was sort of saying to me for the 4 years after London was like, if you just get gold, like, you'll be the greatest of all time, like your career will be complete. And it was sort of that one thing that I felt was missing in my career. And knowing that I was going to have to get my knee fixed after Rio, it was like, and I was sort of getting towards my late 20s. I knew that was kind of crunch time for me. And I felt like I went in the best shape of my life. And that's, you never know when you're going to get that opportunity again to show up in Olympics in that kind of shape and have everything go that right until the last hurdle. So it was pretty disappointing. And right before my race, my fiance at the time, Elise, had just won a silver medal. So, I mean, after the race, I had my little moment of disappointment, but you try to pick yourself up pretty quick and be there for her and celebrate her medal, because it's an amazing achievement and something she was there for me 4 years earlier when I'd won my medal. And anyway, I guess after the Olympics, I just didn't really probably take the time that I needed to deal with that loss, you know, both physically and mentally. And I was back at a race in Kentucky 3 weeks after the Olympics and actually consequently made the exact same mistake at that race. And then from there, I really just kind of spiraled a little bit out of control, I'd say, not in a bad way, but from a training standpoint, in that I just buried my head in the sand and felt like I was just was just chasing that next win to make up for Rio. And after that race in Kentucky, I was supposed to go back to Minnesota with my fiance Elise for a charity event and celebration deal for her medal. And I changed my flight, went back to San Diego, and was just kind of like head in the sand, got to keep training, you know, win the next race. And it was that next weekend that my accident happened. I was, it was a Saturday, September 10th of 2016, and just went to the track here, the track that I trained at every day for the past 6 years, just a routine warm-up, and went I used to always go through the rhythm section, which was like a bunch of little jumps in a row, and I'd always go through them on my back wheel in my warm-up, and it was just kind of like signify to me like that I was warmed up and ready to go. And it was in that warm-up that I just came in a little quicker than normal and felt myself flipping off the back of my bike, and probably just tried to overcorrect a bit too much. And I actually went up into the air and half into a backflip and came down, landed straight on the top of my head. And yeah, I was basically instantly paralyzed. And thankfully I didn't get any sort of head injury or concussion, but also I remember every second of the accident. And I remember being in the air and flipping backwards and kind of thinking like, all right, I've been here before. Like I flipped off the back of my bike hundreds of times as a kid, and you know, you land on your back, you knock the wind out of yourself, and it's a horrible feeling, but you're okay. And I remember when I hit the ground, just thinking like, I'm not winded. And then all this is obviously happening in a split second, and then realizing that I couldn't feel my legs, and just felt like my legs were like way off in the distance. And that was when I, yeah, really panicked and just tried to stay as still as I could.
So who was with you at the time? Was there anyone with you at the track, and people at New York?
It was just a local public practice session. So Elise was in Minnesota. Obviously my whole family is in Australia. So, I mean, I was at the track by myself, but yeah, there were people there, other people. And there was one rider that was down there, and she looked at me and I was like screaming, I can't feel my legs. And she obviously waved for help. And one of the guys that came down, luckily he was actually an EMT, and he kind of knew right away and kept me really still. And they obviously called for an ambulance and did all that kind of stuff. And while we were waiting, he kept running through all these checks, and he started at my toes, like squeezing my toes, can you feel this? And no. And he'd go the whole way up my body, and he got to my chest, and he had his hands like on my chest, and I could see his hand there, and he's like, can you feel this? And I couldn't feel his hand, and I could see his hand was right there, but it felt like his hand was like 2 feet off of my chest. It just felt like my whole body was in this wetsuit full of water, is the best way I can describe it. And the first time he ran through the checks, he went down my arms and he asked if I could squeeze his hand. And I really gingerly like squeezed his hand the first time he did the check. And then he kept doing the checks. And the second time he went through the check, he got to my hands and I couldn't squeeze his hand. And that was, yeah, when real panic sort of set in for me, because basically the lights were out from my neck down.
That must have been, I can't imagine how terrifying that whole instant experience was, especially not to have essentially people you really knew around you.
I'd say it was got scarier and scarier as the paramedics got there, and then they didn't really even run any checks. They kind of, I think, knew what the situation was, and it was just about getting me out of there as quick as possible. And they didn't feel like they could drive the ambulance out of there safely because I was in such a fragile state. Obviously, they knew that my spine had broken and was pinching they knew that there was some damage to my spinal cord because of the paralysis. So they didn't, but at this point, I didn't know anything, and I wasn't in any pain. I was just motionless, and they, at that point, I was strapped so tight to a backboard, like even if I wanted to try to like start moving things, or the advice was to be very still, and I was so strapped so tight, there wasn't any chance that I was going to be trying to move anything. And they put me in the back of an ambulance and basically said they were going to wait for a helicopter. And then a helicopter arrived and was shoved in the back of that and flown to the hospital. And it was, yeah, a pretty scary experience. Just once I got to the hospital, like just being on that backboard and being raced through the hospital. And at that, you know, that's when I felt really alone, because it was kind of like in that extreme emergency situation where you just feel yourself, you know, you're just looking at the roof as you're on this backboard being raced through a hospital with a bunch of doctors around you, you know, prodding you and no one to really turn to.
So when did you first hear the diagnosis, and what was the diagnosis?
Yeah, so I, like I was saying, when I was being rushed through the hospital and that kind of thing, there was a younger female nurse there, and she was with her, and I made eye contact, and I could see kind of like a tear in her eye, and I said to her, "Am I dying?" And she just answered up, "We don't know. You've sustained a severe neck injury, and we need to get you stabilized as soon as possible." And whether if that was like an overreaction or not at the time, like when you don't get a yes or no answer when you're strapped on a backboard paralyzed, it's a pretty daunting place to be. And the next thing that happened was I was shoved in an MRI machine. And I mean, those are pretty daunting places at the best of times. But when you're paralyzed from the neck down, they're extremely claustrophobic and scary. I remember the doctor still had the nerve to say, "Don't move for the next 45 minutes. I was like, "I'm not moving." So anyway, I did the MRI, then was pulled out and then basically put into like a little room or curtained off room in emergency, and was still no idea what my injury was, and was obviously just strapped to this board still. And like I said, I didn't have any pain, and just, I didn't feel anything. And then eventually he was a surgeon. He came around. He didn't really introduce himself or anything. He just said, "Close your eyes and tell me what I'm doing." So I did that. And he said, "What am I doing?" And I said, "You're squeezing my right big toe." And he said, "Okay, we need to go now." And I was kind of like, "Go where?" He's like, "We need to go to surgery now." And at that point, like, I'd never even been under the knife. So like my initial thought, like being in the elite sport for as long as I was at that point, like every time you are in that situation where it's like go to surgery or something like that, it's always like you call home to your team, like,
yeah,
you know, who's the best surgeon, who's this, who's that. And that was where my mind went. Like I haven't even spoke to Elise hardly. I haven't spoke to mom and dad. Like, I haven't spoke to our team doctor. Like, and he's like, "No, we need to go now. Like, you've broken your C5, 6, 7 vertebrae. C6 is a burst fracture and it's crushing your spinal cord. And if we don't relieve that pressure, like, your chances of recovery are zero." And the next thing I asked him was, "Do you know what you're doing?" And he said, "Yeah, we need to go now." And he did. He laid out the risks and sort of said, like, when we go in there and we're pulling those bone fragments out of your spinal cord, because it's such a fragile area, like if we hit any higher or do any more damage, like there is always that chance of, you know, permanent paralysis. And at that point, permanent paralysis was the neck down.
Wow. So what did happen to people like Elise and your parents, and where were they whilst all this was, obviously you said Elise was in America still, but yeah, where was everyone else and when did they find out?
Yeah. So mom and dad were in Adelaide and my brother, and the people from the track had contacted all of, like, Elise and mom and dad. And, Elise was straight on a plane, from Minnesota. So she was, while I was in surgery, she was flying to LA, and then someone had gone up to grab her from LA and drive her, because that was the quickest way to get her there. So by the time I woke up from the 6-hour surgery, she was, like, by the time I'd woken up from the anesthesia and everything, was probably at least another, probably around 7 or 8 hours. And by that time she was at my bedside. And she basically informed my mum and dad a bit, and they were on the next flight out of Australia. On their way.
Wow. That must have been such a tough moment for them as well. And really hard
and
to
that was that. Yeah, that was probably the hardest thing for me when I had woken up from it all. It was like, and the doctor had come around and they'd started using the term of permanent paralysis. And I think just the thought of like mum and dad, my brother getting that phone call, and they're, you know, sitting on a plane for 30 hours and just being told that Sam's a quadriplegic, like I just felt a lot of guilt and like just scared for everyone really at that point, because I was so unsure of, I didn't know what the future held. And just to think that, especially thinking of like your mom sitting on a plane for 30 hours and that's all they've been told, is pretty scary thing.
You spoke about it, you having a sense of guilt. Where did your mind go after receiving the news and sort of in the coming days following?
Yeah, well, the first thing I said when I seen Elise was, you're not marrying me, you're not marrying a cripple. And I regret saying that now, because I'm not a cripple, but at the time I was so scared. Like, I didn't know what we were 25 years old and, the world at our feet kind of thing. And then this just happens and it was all out. I felt that a lot of it came from me just chasing something that didn't need to be chased at a certain time. And I just didn't want to hold up her life. And I just felt like a burden on everyone at that point. And that was kind of just where my mind went at that moment. And she was just solid from the get-go, never once wavered, and just right away from that moment said, I'm not going anywhere and we're going to find a way. And she, in the space of the last 4 years, I think she cried in front of me once, like just
wow.
Was like, next thing, like, how do we help make you the best you can be? And she's never once put, like, if I wanted to try to walk again, it was like, that was because I wanted to try to do it. She told me from the get-go, I don't care if you're sitting in that wheelchair. So I'm very lucky to have, those kinds of people around me. And
incredible. That's so another level of support that not many people will get to feel at some stage. So when you started to go into rehabilitation and the rehab process, what did that look like for you, and what was your mindset going into it?
Yeah, so for the first 2 weeks, I was in basically like emergency in hospital, where I was just on my back, needed help with everything. Basically, like, someone was by my side every night in the hospital, and my brother was suctioning saliva out of my mouth because I didn't really have the hand function to grab the vacuum or wipe saliva off my face. And and when they did the surgery, because they went in through the front of my neck, like, they'd tied my esophagus up for 6 hours, so my throat was all swollen, like I couldn't eat. And so just the first 2 weeks were pretty bad. But even then, I think just laying on my back in hospital, not really trying to do anything and just thinking I'm recovering. At that point, when I was laying on my back for those 2 weeks, I really thought, like, once I'm stable enough to go to rehab, I'll be able to work hard enough to fix this. And it was only at around day 14 when they sat me up for the first time, and I instantly fainted and shit myself. And that was when I realized, like, the lack of hand function I had, I had no more core function. I couldn't even sit up. Like, every time I was any form of vertical, like, I would just faint. And that was kind of where I realized the task that was ahead of me and the complications that were going to come with this injury. And it wasn't just learning to walk again. And it was around that time that then I was deemed medically stable enough to be put on another medical flight and flown to what we determined as the best rehab place for me to go to for spinal cord injury, which was Craig Hospital in Colorado, in Denver. So I was flown there on like a little private plane. It was just me and my mom and two doctors. It was basically another hospital, but with a spinal cord and brain injury specialty, I guess. So, yeah, and then I was there for 4 months.
Wow, 4 months. That's insane. So when did you get, what level did you have to get to be able to leave that sort of
place? So I was an inpatient, which is essentially hospital, where you basically live in a hospital room and you're sort of still full-time care. I was inpatient until the beginning of December. And then I was outpatient where they moved us into like a little apartment, and with Elise's help, we were kind of living there, and I was still going to the rehab center every day. Well, we're still living at the hospital, but I was doing rehab at the hospital every day. We were there for the month of December while we sort of made adjustments to our house to give us a bit more time before we went home. I guess the point of where I could leave inpatient to become outpatient was, it was really just about getting me medically stable, like as far as breathing, getting the neck brace off. So the neck brace came off. It was almost 3 months that was on for, once they felt the hardware was stable enough and that kind of thing. And then there was just, it was teaching basically Elise and the people around me of sort of how to care for me, because it was everything from going to the bathroom, taking a shower, you know, learning about all the things that come with spinal cord injury, from, you know, pressure sores to, infections that you don't even know, you can't feel, and how to monitor things, and just learning how to manage all that stuff. So it was the medically stable part was one part, and then the caring and the learning all that side of things was the other part. So that was around the beginning of December, I guess, when we got to that point.
So when you said you had the injury, and you said about the doctor touching your chest, or the paramedic mm-hmm. touching your chest, you obviously couldn't move your arms, and now and you're fit guy with upper body strength that's pretty big on the upper body. What was that progression? So what did you start to regain, and how did that look after?
So it was about, by the time I'd got to Craig, the hospital in Denver, I'd sort of had movement in my arms, but my hands, I didn't really have like dexterity in my fingers or anything. But I was able to move my arms. My triceps didn't function. Like I couldn't flex my tricep or like extend my arm overhead or anything. And then that just sort of slowly progressed. But even like at the end of December, when we left Denver and came home, I still wasn't really, like I wasn't at a point where I could transfer myself into a car or into bed, or transfer myself from my wheelchair to a shower wheelchair, or I just didn't have any tricep function really. But I had movement in my arms, and my hands at that point. Like my left hand is still pretty bad. Not, I'm always careful saying bad, because there's so many people that with my injury whose hands are a lot worse at this point still. But like, for example, I wouldn't be able to open like a Coke bottle with my left hand. And if I do stuff in the gym, like I need a grip assistance on it, like a glove or something. And that's sort of, yeah, it's just slowly progressed over time. And it's really hard to fully remember, because it's not like with recovery of this stuff, it's not like, oh, October 20th, my tricep came back. Slow. And you just notice little things over time. Like I'm still now slowly getting more feeling on the inside of my arms. Like I still can't really feel temperature on the inside of my arms, but like on my forearm now, if I scratch it, like I can feel the sharpness of the scratch, but right. That was all numb for probably 3 years. Like, so it's, yeah. And it's hard to keep track of like when exactly that changed, cause it happens so slowly.
Yeah. I imagine it's one of those things where you're just like, oh, I've suddenly recognized I've got that, that now.
And yeah.
And yeah. Yeah. Were there any sort of certain goals that you were setting yourself along the way?
Yeah, my goal from the get-go was like I wanted to walk again. Obviously, that was like the biggest thing for me. I felt that was, for me, that was like the definition of recovery from the injury was like walking. And I mean, a big thing that comes with spinal cord injury is like you lose your bowel and bladder function, which is like the most complicated, one of the biggest complications of it. And I remember someone said to me in hospital, was like, he was in a similar situation. He's like, I'd way rather be able to take a piss by myself again than be able to walk. And I was like, nah, I'd rather walk. And I think now I would probably go the other route.
Yeah.
Because it's those things are so much more complicated. But yeah, I mean, early on it was, for me, it was walk. Like I just wanted to walk. And I felt like if I walked again, that would solve all of my problems. And so that I went hard at that for 2 years, just trying to get some sort of function in my legs again. And I really, even though my hands were bad, like my arms moved, I didn't really even want to rehab my arms, because I just felt like they were good enough. Like I wanted to stand up. I wanted to be in a position where if I went in public, people didn't see a wheelchair, you know, and because I was so insecure about that for the longest time. And just when I just thought of practicality of life, like learning to transfer onto your bed and learning to transfer into the car and pull your wheelchair into the car and all these things, you have to learn to gain independence again, and learning how to, you know, cook again, and learning how to brush your teeth again and move around a house and move around the street. I was like, well, the simplest way to solve all that would be just walk again.
Yeah.
But it's not that easy. So anyway, I went hard at trying to get function in my legs for the first 2 years. I did rehab every day, twice a day, and tried every, you know, wacky Eastern medicine thing that we could find, and just tried everything really to try to get a flicker or a, you know, a toe to wiggle or something that showed a sign of progression in that area. And I was able to get to a point where I was able to stand at our wedding and ultimately shuffle down the aisle with the assistance of some leg braces. So I had like full length leg braces, and I was able to gain enough upper body strength that I could kind of manipulate my spasms in my hip that would kind of like flick my leg forward. So it was more or less, I guess, manipulating my spasms and tone that I had in my muscles still to kind of make that happen. But it wasn't like actual practical, like function that I can use day to day.
Yeah. I've seen the video of your wedding, and I think around the time you got married, the videos came out and like Alex had carried, had shared them, and like, it's one of the most moving videos. It's incredible. And you'd spoken about.
Sorry,
carry on.
I was going to say, it's obviously the most special day of my life. And I think more than any, like, it was for me, but in a way it was like for so many other people in that room that day, of just to show that, I don't know, it's just like almost an appreciation thing. And just to show that no matter what, like, Elise and I were going to find a way in life from that point forward.
Had Elise been a part of that process of trying to get you down the aisle?
Absolutely, every day. I mean, practicing in the backyard every day, like for the year leading up to it, and many days where it just didn't even seem possible. And she, like I said earlier, from the get-go, she was very much like, she didn't care if we got married and I sat in the wheelchair, and she was perfectly content with that side of me. But it was I just wanted to be at that point. And if we were to get married today, I don't know if I would stand up. I think I'm at a point now where I've got myself to a point where I'm confident and happy enough in myself. But at that point, I felt that I wanted, that was the wedding that we were looking forward to before this happened. And I just wanted her to have pictures of us standing together. And I think it was very much for me to like signify to her that whatever it is, we'll work through it and find a way.
Yeah. Like I said, it's one of the most moving scenes to see that. You spoke about your insecurities of when you probably first got into a wheelchair and your situation. Was there a turning point for that for you? Was there a moment when you just started to accept it and go, this is Sam now for the moment?
Yeah, probably the biggest turning point was about 7 months after the injury. It was around April of 2017. And my brother had been living here in San Diego with us and his wife. And my mom was back and forth as well, basically from January. And my dad and I'd just been hellbent on recovery. Like it was every day was just stay in the house and do rehab. And when I wasn't doing rehab, it was like lay in bed and visualize and try to make a movement or do something. And I didn't want to leave the house. I didn't have much self-confidence and I didn't really want to be seen with Elise in public because I just felt like everyone was looking like, I just felt like people were looking at her like, oh, poor her, she's with him, or like, why is he with her? And because at that point, you know, I had to be pushed up hills. I wasn't strong enough to push myself around most places and just didn't really know how to deal with that at that point. And it was, around April that my brother was pretty adamant for me to get out the house and, you know, sort of keep working at this goal of wanting to recover. But he was always very much pushing me in the direction of like, you can still do so much and like, you can still be independent and you can still create a life for yourself. And like, you're not useless basically. And he'd had not really any experience with spinal cord injury, but he just picked it up from the get-go and was like, started just researching stuff and reaching out to people. And right away, he just was like trying to get me out the house, trying to get me to the gym, trying to get me to start driving, trying to get me to find a way, like push forward, like make your own way. Like don't just get stuck in this rut of like it's walk or nothing. So anyway, it was around April that he knew that I loved NASCAR and there was a NASCAR race about 2 hours away in Fontana. And he was like, we're going to this race. So he'd called a friend of mine that worked in the industry and organized these tickets and organized, basically thrown me in the car and driven up there and said, like, we're going. And the guy who got the tickets, he'd organized like this full VIP sort of thing, you know, meet and greets of all these drivers. And which I was pretty insecure about at that time, because still at that point, everyone introduced me as Sam, the BMX world champion. And I can tell like when people do that, the other guy's looking back like, well, how does that work? Like,
yeah.
And like, well, why, you know, but they obviously don't ask. And I didn't really even know how to interact with that. That was my first real outing in a wheelchair. But anyway, the guy that organized the tickets, he said at 10 o'clock, like, make sure you go to the number 13 hauler. There's a guy you need to meet and his name's Booty Barker. And he's in a wheelchair and I need you to meet this guy. And Matt and I, that's my brother, Matt. We were a bit like, okay. Like at that point, I didn't really want to meet anyone in a wheelchair. And as terrible as that is for me to say, that's how I felt at that point, because I just didn't want that to be me. And I didn't want to learn about living in a wheelchair. I didn't want to be in a wheelchair. So anyway, out of respect, we went to the number 13 hauler and met Booty. And here's this guy, he comes wheeling out the back of this semi-trailer, big wheelie down the back. And he's like big Southern guy, like pretty solid, well-built and, you know, very capable. And he's like, hey, Sam, how you going? I'm Booty Barker. And just the most like upbeat, funny guy you've ever met. And he pulls us in the back of his trailer, and like Matt pushes me up in there, and Booty's like climbing around all the walls and pulling out exhaust manifolds and showing us his engine data on his laptop. And Booty is, he's a crew chief for this multi-million dollar NASCAR team at the top level. And he's a qualified engineer, and he basically runs this team, and he's just full of life. And he looked at me and he's like, "How long have you been injured for, Sam?" And I was like, "Oh, 7 months." And he's like, "You look great, brother. What are you going to do now?" And I was kind of like, didn't really know how to answer that, because I had no idea what I was going to do. Like, and my brother kind of answered it for me. And he's like, "You know, Sam's working on his recovery. He really wants to walk at his wedding at the end of the year." And then Booty's like, "That's great. Then what?" And I was like, didn't know how to answer that. And my brother sort of awkwardly like asked Booty, like, "When did you like stop doing rehab?" And he's like, "Rehab? I didn't do no rehab. He don't need no rehab. He's fine." Oh. And he was basically like, they said if he could put his shoes on and get in and out of his wheelchair, he could leave the hospital. And he said he did that in a month and got out of there and got his engineering degree and got on with it. And for us, like, until that point, everyone that had spoke to us was like, you know, if you drive a car, you know, you're going to have a minivan, it's going to have a ramp. And, you know, when you travel, you're going to have to go to the airport this much earlier, and you have to call the hotel and make sure it's got this and got that. And just everything had like a limitation on it, and everything just seemed too hard kind of thing. Mm. And like independence just kind of fell out of the picture at that point. And I just felt like I was kind of like this object that everyone had to keep alive in many ways. And Booty was just kind of like, nah, like, he's like, you want to drive an F-350? He's like, you get it, get yourself strong, get up in it. Wow. And it was just, he was just so, you know, lived his own life, was very independent. I mean, he traveled 36 weekends a year to these NASCAR events and telling us he drives an F-350 and how high his bed is and stays in normal hotels and just does what he wants. And then he's like, "Do you work out?" And I was like, I used to love going to the gym, but no, not really anymore, like, obviously. And he's like, "Oh, you're going to have to go to the gym, brother." He's like, "Me? I bench 140 kilos and I do pull-ups." He's like, "You're going to have to get strong, brother. You're going to be pulling yourself around a lot." And then he looked at my brother and he said, "Here's the deal. Me and him, we're the same as you. We're just going to have to drag ourselves around a little more." And wow. Those were the words that I lived by basically from that day forward. Was like, me and Matt left that NASCAR event and we went back to the hotel and we're like all motivated, like, "Let's figure out how to get you in the bathtub, and like, let's figure out how to make you get in bed yourself." And that was like, I went home from there that day with this whole new energy of like, I'm just going to be what I want to be and figure it out. And wow. And I had to start small, like brushing my own teeth again, like putting my own shoes on, getting myself in and out of bed and start driving a car again, learn how to pull my wheelchair in and just figure it out. And me and Matt started going to the gym again. And from that point forward, I just really took the knowledge I learned in hospital of the stuff you have to know about spinal cord injury and the stuff you have to be aware of. But for the most part, just find my own way at that point. Yeah.
Did you feel like you had a bit of an identity shift? Did you feel you were this sort of identity before, and then bang, I've now recognized I can change that?
Yeah, and it really took meeting someone in a similar situation for me to recognize that and see that it's possible and in many respects. And that's, I think, my biggest goal in many ways now is trying to be that person for others that unfortunately get put in this situation. And I hate getting the phone call or the message, but just helping them realize there's so much life to live still. And, you know, it's really, a lot of my public speaking is geared around embracing the struggle. And that's life for everyone. You know, we all have our own little individual struggles, and it's really just about learning to embrace them and enjoy the challenge of overcoming them. And I always tell the story of the first time I dressed myself, like it took me 35 minutes. And by the time I was done, I just laid back down in bed and went to sleep because I was exhausted. But it gradually got better and better and better. And the learning curve of that sucks because, I mean, you get to 25 years of age and you're relearning how to dress yourself and you're relearning how to brush your teeth, drive a car, you know, do all this mundane stuff that is really hard to get motivated to do at that point of your life, let alone when I hear of like a 15-year-old or something that's going to high school still and has to go through that. It breaks my heart, but I feel like my obligation to try to, you know, help steer them in a motivated direction to be the best version of themselves still.
Yeah. Well, it feels like there's this, and anyone in the world feels like they can label themselves a certain person or a certain way or certain attributes. But what's sort of speaking out from your story is that you were able to, yes, you had probably labeled yourself a certain type in one scenario. Then there was an accident that happens. You label yourself again. And now you've changed that again. And recognizing no matter what you feel you are, there's always the ability to change it. You can always change that.
100%. Yeah. And I think that was big. Like when I was in hospital, it was always like, oh, this is Sam. He's a C6 incomplete quadriplegic. And I remember like really early on, Elise was like, no, nah, I'm not saying that. Like you're Sam. And, yeah. And for us from the get-go, it was never like, we didn't use those labels because if you would tell me that Booty was a C6 quadriplegic, I would, there's no way you would ever know that. Like you talk to him for 5 minutes and you forget he's in a wheelchair. And I think that's so big to, you know, express that and not put labels on people. And obviously in the medical field, you have to have those things at first, but it's very important once you get out there to branch out and make your own path with it.
I'd heard you talk about how you took responsibility for your recovery and for your for yourself at one stage. Can you talk a little bit more about how was there like a little bit of a penny dropping? Was it that encounter with Booty and taking that responsibility for your own self? That's quite a stoic thing to say as well. Like it's a very stern way of thinking.
Yeah, prior to that, like I said earlier, it was like the biggest thing was independence. Like when you're 25 years old and you go from trying to win an Olympic gold medal to having someone shower you, they're worlds apart. And so for me, the biggest thing was like, I can't live my life being cared for by others. Like I can't. That for me, I just couldn't handle that. And at first I thought the only way to achieve that was to walk again, to be vertical. And that was the only way I was going to be able to be in that situation. But then meeting Booty, it kind of was a shift there. And that was a tipping point for me in that I realized I could take responsibility for my own actions going forward. And I could create the person I wanted to be, because like I said, there were so many like rules and limitations on what I could do because I was a C6 quadriplegic. So like there was just norms that went with that, like, all right, you're a C6 quadriplegic, like therefore you won't be able to do this, and you will have to drive this car and you'll need this bed, and that's just what C6 quadriplegics have to have. And then I met Booty and it's like, well, he's C6 quadriplegic and he's not doing any of that. He's living a totally normal life and just dragging himself around, as he said. So then I went home from that and it was like not a matter of copying how Booty did everything, but I just stopped putting limitations on it. Like I didn't go to the medical book to see if I could do that or not. I just tried it and suffered the consequences if it didn't work out perfectly, and then tried to fix it and eventually got myself to a point where now I do live an independent life and I do take care of myself, and everything we do is normally, you know, I've traveled the world by myself. I've traveled the world with Elise, and I wake up every day and handle my business. Is my day different than what it used to be and different to maybe what yours would be? Yeah, it's very different. There's so many things I have to think about every day that not a quote unquote normal person wouldn't, but I learned to enjoy that challenge of that. And I think my sporting background gave me the ability to be organized enough and to appreciate the step-by-step and the process to do that every day. I mean, if I have to wake up 2 hours earlier than someone else to be ready at the same time, I just do it without talking about it because I want to be seen as normal. I don't want to be seen or treated as different. And if I don't want to be treated as different, then I have to give and show, I have to show the example that I'm not different. You know, I can't be cruising around complaining and you know, playing the woo me card. You know, I just have to get on with it and embrace that challenge every day. And that's sort of, and then I got a real kick and a real motivation out of doing that as time went on. And
yeah,
and I end my days sometimes and look back like, wow, 3 years ago to think I just did all that in a day, and that wouldn't have even been on my radar 3 years ago. And I get a real sense of pride out of that to do it again the next day.
Yeah, that embracing the struggle, what you said, I think that's such a key point for a load of people, especially in the world we live in the last year. People are having struggles. Mm-hmm. Your struggle is by far a huge extreme, but there are people that have massively faced struggles, whether that's financial, yep, health, mm-hmm, anything throughout this last year, yep, whilst the pandemic's going on. And I think I've always, as much of the struggles that I've had personally in my own sporting journey and what I face day to day, or I just think you're so true. Embracing it is the way that teaches you. You have to have that night in order to have the day. You have to have the low, yep, to have a high. No one, yep, if you're looking for that comfort day to day, it's that there's no high.
Reality.
No, it's not, yeah, reality. There's no high because you've not gone, yeah, down. You've not gone down into, mm-hmm, that trough to find that peak. And that I wish is one thing, especially for kids. I think especially for kids, because they run from those fears, yeah, the failures, the struggles. This is too hard. I can't get it. And mm-hmm, and that is the good bit. That's the bit that makes you strong. That's the bit that, yeah, changes you, makes you realize it. It completely changes how you go about your life and your sport, whatever it may be.
For sure. Yep. 100%.
Was there, when you started going into coaching now, so for people who are listening, at least we've mentioned her a couple of times, but she is in her own right an extremely successful BMX rider. So she's world champion, silver gold medalist, and yep, you guys are hopefully heading towards Tokyo. And she's clearly been one of your biggest supports in what you've gone through, but now you're supporting her in what's been your, I guess, learnings of taking what you did on the bike to now coaching? How does the dynamic work as well as having your own wife as your athlete that you're, yeah, training?
It works really well, I think, just from the perspective of, like, I'm not a drill sergeant in that she wants to be doing this, and it's something that we just decided. Obviously, she went through her own struggle with it as well. Like, is it worth me doing this still? And, like, look at what this did to you. And it really took me, I think, having that conversation with her in those early days in hospital was like, no, this BMX didn't do this to me. This was an accident. And, you know, you're still so good at this. And having that purpose in life is so important. And, like, for her to just, because originally, you know, early on, she wanted to say, like, is it worth, you know, like, why do I care? Like, what's the point of caring? There's bigger things than caring about this. And it was like, no, this, it matters to care about, you know, winning a bike race. It matters to care about winning a sporting event, because that, mm-hmm, that gives you a sense of purpose day to day. And that gives you something to, we need that, I think, as humans, is something to strive for. And we can't just live in this, you know, fairy tale, like we said, of just everything's, you know, rosy and we shouldn't ever push ourselves. And she was too much of a talent to just walk away from it at that point based on just guilt of competing. And I don't have any, like, I mean, I still go to the track that I crashed at every day of the week, and I'd never think twice about it just because it was circumstantial. It wasn't like that track did that to me, or it wasn't like the sport did that to me. It was an accident. And I just, you know, it's that competitive side of coaching that's kept me going. I needed something still. That competitive streak, that's still in me. Like, that didn't die when I got hurt. So I need something to fuel that with still. And so if she wanted to keep racing, I mean, there's no one out there that wants her to do better than I do. And fortunately, I had somewhat of a skill set in that area to help her. And whatever I didn't know, I was going to study and learn and try to just make her preparation the best it could be. And we just started getting after it, and she had more and more success. And it's just been a really fun little journey for the two of us. And it's not, yeah, like I said, I don't know, on paper it sounds really tough, like husband wife coaching, but it's really quite flawless and easy, I think, because for us it's we're just embarking on a journey that there's so much upside no matter the result, because we're learning to just work on something together that is just fun, and we're learning about each other, and we're learning that later in life, you know, we're going to have a skill set to attack anything that we want to. I think from the experiences we're creating that we don't even probably know we're creating.
Yeah. How are things looking for Tokyo?
Yeah, really good. So Elise's the current world champion. She's won the last two World Cups before this whole COVID thing happened. And yeah, just training her butt off and doing really well. And fortunate to have, you know, some good people in our corner helping us. And she's got a lot of great sponsors behind her. And she's just, yeah, getting better and better every day. She turned 30 this year. And I think she's riding better than she ever has. And she just, yeah, I've never seen an athlete in our sport, especially, and I'd question any sport that puts as much into it as she does, and just has as, I always tell her that she's battle tested, because she's just been through so much in the last, you know, 8 years. She lost her mum to cancer in 2014, and then has had her own, you know, challenges with injuries and ups and downs, and she gets on the gate every week and just is so in tune with her own body and her own mind, and is able to just, you know, find a way in some of the toughest of situations. And, you know, one thing that stands out is a couple of years ago, she was going for the USA BMX pro title. And the day before the event, I had a coffee between my legs, and when I was pushing around, and I didn't realize how hot it was. And when we got home that night to the hotel, and I took my jeans off, and I had like third degree burns on the inside of my leg. And I didn't obviously even know it, because I couldn't feel it. And so it was Thanksgiving in America, so like no emergency rooms were really, like, obviously the hospital was open, but no, like, couldn't get a hold of any doctors or chemists or anything. And she was basically up all night driving around town trying to get me stuff so that we could treat these burns without going to the hospital at that point. And then she shows up that next day. No, I mean, I've never even told that story. Like, no one would even know about it. And she just shows up the next day and doesn't talk about it. You know, probably got a few hours sleep and gets on the gate and finds a way. And I think that that's just a testament to her, in that, you know, it's about kind of what I was saying before, like how my day might be complicated, more complicated than yours, but it's about you embrace that challenge of doing those things behind closed doors without having to, you know, promote them or talk about them. And I think that's when you build real character, and that's, yeah, when you really sort of learn about yourself. And I think that's a hard thing in this day and age, is that, you know, with social media and stuff, it's like everyone wants a pat on the back for every little challenge that we go through. And whilst it's good to talk about problems as well, I think there's real strength in handling yourself behind closed doors. And there's just certain things that we all should just do as good people, and we should just do because they're the right thing to do. And you don't need a pat on the back, you just do it because you know it's the right thing to do, and you know that that will lead to the ultimate success.
Even there, like, you don't, not everything has to be perfect in order to do well as well. Like, it doesn't,
right?
Even in sport, you can think like, right, I have to have this routine, and but you can leave some openness for a challenge that's just going to crop up, or a little mini change, and you might have to adapt, but you can still have that strength of character,
flexibility. Yeah.
That, so last question really from me, it would be, what is all of these experiences that you've got, and you and Elise have gone through some of the highest highs and the lowest lows, and together, and hopefully some more high highs coming up soon. And but what is it that's taught you the most from where you were as that young kid coming onto BMX scene to where you are now?
I think that probably that courage is something that's within us all, and it takes maybe being hit head on with a challenge for us to realize what we're really capable of at times. And I think, just the capability of the human being really is probably the thing that just amazes me every day, is like, even just sitting there and you watch people walk around. Like, for me now, I watch people walk and it's like, it's amazing what the body can do. And I guess what I've learned is that I don't really live in fear of any failure anymore or any hurdle, because I just feel like, when there's a will, there's a way. And those words have never probably rang more true to me than they do now.
Yeah. Wow. Sam, you're such an inspirational person. I'm so glad I got to meet you, and I'm so glad we got to do this. So thank you so much for your time. If people want to reach out to you, where's the best place to find you?
I mean, I'm on Instagram. I'm not great on it, but I'm on there. I think it's just swillaby91_. So just get in touch with me on there, or I'm around. I'm doing a bit of public speaking now, so if there's anyone out there that's interested in any of that, I'm with Management Group TLA, so you can reach out to TLA for any of that kind of stuff. I've done talks with sporting teams, schools, corporate business, all that kind of stuff, so it's something that I enjoy doing.
Yeah, I'll leave all the links in the show notes for people to grab a hold of you, so it'd be real easy should they want to get a hold of Sam Willoughby. But mate, thank you so much for this. You've been an absolute legend, and I wish you all the best for what's coming up over the next few months. Actually, it's going to be an interesting time.
It is, yeah. Thank you very much for having me on. I appreciate it.
No worries. This episode is brought to you by Sport Yogi, the app for athletes to build the connection between body and mind. Using methods such as yoga, mindfulness, mobility training, breathing exercises, and much more, the Sport Yogi app will help you at becoming a better athlete every day. To sign up now to your free account, head over to www.sportyogi.com or head over to the iOS or Android stores, where you can download the Sport Yogi app completely free today. If you're part of a team, club, or school program, then Sport Yogi has a discounted offer that brings the Sport Yogi app to your squads and provides the boost in well-being and performance that you could be looking for. For teams and clubs, head over to sportyogi.com/teams. And for schools, head over to sportyogi.com/schools. Thanks for listening to the Raising Your Game podcast. You can find out more at lewishatchett.com, or head to Instagram at lewishatchett, or even head over to YouTube. If you found this podcast useful, then please do feel free to leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Simply head to Apple Podcasts, find the show, scroll all the way to the bottom, leave your review, and it really does help. Anyway, I will see you next time.